What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions, like why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Liam Fox and welcome to Pacific Review. We'll take a look at the big stories from the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up, pain still lingers 50 years after the murders of the Balabo Five in Timor-Leste. The environmental time bomb ticking away at the bottom of Micronesia's waters, and a rare case of conjoined twins delivered successfully in a rural hospital in Papua New Guinea. We'll have more on those stories coming up. Pacific Review comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. First, excitement is building in Papua New Guinea ahead of the canonisation of the country's first Catholic saint, Peter Torot. Some of his descendants are travelling to the Vatican to witness Pope Leo XIV declare Blessed Peter Torot a saint during a ceremony in St. Peter's Basilica on Sunday evening local time. Thousands of others are expected to watch a telecast of the ceremony in his home village in East New Britain, as Belinda Cora reports.
Blessed Peter Torot was just 33 years old when he was killed through lethal injection by Japanese soldiers in 1945. He was arrested and martyred for opposing polygamy following an order executed by the Japanese authorities that wanted to reintroduce the practice. This all happened in his village of Rakunai, where he is originally from. Despite Japanese restrictions on Christian practices, Peter secretly organized catechism classes, prepared couples for marriage, taught children, visited the sick, and distributed Holy Communion across villages, often walking for 5 to 6 hours to reach them. According to the Catholic Church, such pastoral work and the death of Blessed Peter Torot deserves the recognition of sainthood. Father Thomas Ravaioli is an Argentine missionary and is the vice postulator of the canonization of Peter Torot and has worked in PNG for 15 years.
You should follow the example of this man, because this man was a real follower, a real disciple of Jesus. So that is the meaning of canonization. The church is telling us, see Peter Torot, look at him and try to follow his example. And in that way, you will be a real follower of Christ, a real disciple.
Father Ravaioli explains why it has taken this long to recognize the life and work of Peter Torot.
It is a work that has to be done here in Papua New Guinea, but also in Rome. So we didn't know very much about the situation in Rome. So it was in 2020 when the bishops asked me to go to Rome and to try to find out. And after I went there, I had a meeting in the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints. I was updated about the situation. And from that moment, 5 years ago, 2020, I was appointed to be in charge of this phase of the cause here in Papua New Guinea.
Peter Torot Senat is one of three of Peter Torot's grandchildren who will also be travelling to the Vatican City to be part of a special service for his grandfather's canonization on Sunday.
It's quite a privilege for us to be attending a ceremony that, you know, we would never thought in our lifetime that we'd be attending such a church event. And we thank God that, you know, we're still alive and, you know, we'll be attending this special occasion with other pilgrims and other bishops also from Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands at this event.
He recalls the work of his grandfather through stories told to him by his mother Rufina, who is the only child to Blessed Peter Torot.
The stories were basically around his faith and what he died for, you know. As he stood firm on the Christian values of honoring one marriage partner, and that was something that the Japanese were trying to introduce polygamy and all this, and Blessed Peter Torot basically stood against that, and that was because of his faith that he was killed at Gunayara in Rabaul.
Meanwhile, preparations are well underway at the Rakunai Catholic Church for the live telecast and celebratory evening of Blessed Peter Torot's canonization on Sunday evening. Hundreds are expected from all around the country and the region to celebrate the work and life of Blessed Peter Torot. Henry Tevolo is the chairman of the Rakunai Catholic Parish in East New Britain province.
So many pilgrims stay with us already here at Rakunai Pilgrim Center. They're from Kavieng, they're from the islands. So many people will come. The parishes, near parishes, will come and join us with this program. So maybe 3,000 to 5,000.
Henry Tevolo from the Rakunai Parish, ending that report from Belinda Cora. This week was the 50-year anniversary of the Balibo 5 murders, five Australian-based journalists working in East Timor who were killed by Indonesian forces as they reported on an invasion in the border town of Balibo. Today, Balibo is a very different place, with the anniversary being used to celebrate press freedom. But the events remain raw for family members of the Balibo 5, and 50 years on, they're still calling for justice. Pacific reporter Nick Sass is in Balibo and filed this report.
Walking around the streets of Balibo, seeing its landmarks and buildings, brings up a mix of heavy emotions for Evan Shackleton. It was in this town 50 years ago where his father took his last breath.
That's the flag house down there, the blue one. And when we came here in 2003, it jumped straight out. It was pretty much the only building left here after the militia had gone, I think. That either smashed, burnt or both. Everything else was here.
The flag house is where Evan's father, Channel 7 reporter Greg Shackleton, painted an Australian flag, nicknaming it the Australian Embassy. The journalists thought it would protect them. It didn't. And Evan's father, along with his four colleagues, were murdered by the invading Indonesian army. For Evan and the Balibo 5 families, it was the start of 50 years of pain, with the Australian government long being accused of a cover-up. And the Indonesian army maintaining, to this day, they were killed in crossfire.
When people lie to you and they pretend that it's the truth and you know it's not the truth, that made me angry.
From the moment they were killed, the government of the day and subsequent governments have just basically covered up what was happening.
That was fellow Balibo 5 family member Greg Cunningham, the brother of murdered journalist Gary Cunningham. He says these days all the families want is an apology. He will not attend the anniversary in Balibo, preferring to have his own day of remembrance in Melbourne.
The next few days, especially the next week, is going to be a rather emotional time.
In a statement, the Australian government said it mourned the deaths and remained committed to transparency. The Indonesian government told the ABC it would prefer to move forward. Neither government offered an apology. Former Victorian Premier Steve Brax is now a fellow of the Balibo House Trust, a charity constructing schools in the region. He says that is one of the positives to come out of the tragic events.
To see that, you know, we've had all these developments that the community in Australia has got behind Balibo and made sure we had something good for the future.
And on the streets in Balibo, they are celebrating. The day is now used to celebrate press freedom. For Evan, this trip is his second time to Balibo after visiting in 2003. And today, although he's still angry, he's found perspective. And what's changed for you since over the past 20 years, seeing it now, Balibo?
I think I feel better about things now. I think I feel some sort of kinship with the people here.
Evan Shackleton, son of murdered journalist Greg Shackleton, ending Nick Sass's report. To Micronesia now, where beneath the waves of Chook Lagoon is an underwater museum like no other. A ghost fleet of ships and aircraft, once part of a formidable Japanese naval base, now dot the floor of the state of Chook's shallow waters. They lie in an abundance of coral and sea life, creating a spectacular realm for tourists. However, Chook's major tourism attraction is also a threat to its survival, as Kyle Evans reports.
Swimming amid the shipwrecks of Micronesia's Chook Lagoon is like diving into a time machine for Ranger Walter.
Like if you go inside the kitchen, you see all the things that we don't even have in Chook, like at that time. It just makes me like addicted to it, like it's another world.
Ranger is the historic preservation officer in the state of Chook. He swims among Chook's 64 shipwrecks often, ensuring the relics and artifacts within remain undisturbed.
You like make sure that there is the place in the kitchen are still there. There's bullets, there is gun, there is handgun, and there is like a lot of bones too, like human remains, yeah.
More than 4,000 Japanese soldiers perished when Chuuk was bombarded by US forces at the tail end of World War II. 63 vessels were sunk in what battlefield historian Mac McLaughlin says was revenge for Pearl Harbor.
As the war went on, they were pushed back quicker and quicker. And yeah, Chuuk is, you know, a perfect example of that, of a base that had been set up as an offensive, base to launch attacks on other areas of the Pacific, soon became a bit of an albatross for them that they were stuck in.
Today, Chuuk Lagoon is home to one of the highest concentrations of World War II shipwrecks in the world. The wrecks, along with the abundance of coral and sea life, make them a bucket list destination for scuba divers, according to Peter Atten, Chuuk's Division Chief of Commerce and Industry.
It is the main driver of our tourism over here. 75 to 80% of our tourism come here because of the shipwrecks.
But in the early 2000s, this ghost fleet of wrecks quite literally came back to haunt them.
Way back in early 2000, that's when we first received reports from our fishermen of leaking oil.
Soon after, oil from the wrecks washed up on shore after a strong storm, sparking an international call for aid from the country's then leader, Manny Mori, who labelled the wrecks a ticking time bomb. Help came via Japan's Mine Action Service, which, according to a recent report, has extracted 60,000 litres of oil from the lagoon since beginning operations in 2017. But it only scratches the surface of the overall threat, with recent estimates suggesting up to 22 million litres could still be contained within the vessels.
What's happening right now with global warming and all that, and what's happening to our sea, the rate of deterioration of our shipwrecks has sped up and has started to erode much quicker than we anticipated.
In February, Australia funded an extensive study of the wrecks at the request of Micronesia's government. The study determined 15 of the wrecks would need to be cleaned within 5 to 10 years to prevent a potential large-scale spill. But in September, just a few months after the study was submitted, disaster struck when one of the vessels assessed in the study sprung a leak, which left a layer of oil 10 centimetres thick on the shoreline of a nearby village.
Currently, we are telling the locals to stay away from the water. The oil has reached inland. The four affected villages don't have deep well. They're using rainwater. So there is no contamination of their local water. But they have been reported cases of dizziness and all like that due to the fumes.
A state of emergency was declared, with Micronesia's president, Wesley Siminna, raising the matter during his address at the UN General Assembly, saying the scale of the problem far exceeds Micronesia's capacity to address the issue alone. However, getting help is not so simple. According to maritime archaeologist Matt Carter, removing oil from shipwrecks and disposing it safely takes place often in other areas of the world, but at a steep price. He said cleaning up a single wreck in Chuuk could cost upwards of $10 million.
The challenge with working in the Pacific, so Chuuk, Solomons and Marshall Islands, is just the sheer distances involved for getting kind of the vessels you'd need, the people, all the equipment there. So the cost is significantly higher than the rest of the world, and the countries in this part of the world are, you know, significantly poorer, generally speaking.
There's also no obligation for countries responsible for putting the wrecks there in the first place to assist, according to Donald Rothwell, a maritime expert and professor of international law at the Australian National University.
The scenario that you're discussing falls within effectively a grey area, because at the time, the modern territories within which these wrecks are located did not exist as independent states. Micronesia has some potential leverage, given its status with the United States under the Compact of Free Association. But otherwise, there is something of a political movement to try to reach a global settlement on this question, but that's a process that will take some time.
In the meantime, Chuuk have applied to have the wrecks placed on the UNESCO World Heritage List to build their profile and shed further light on the issue. Outside of that, Peter Atten says there's not much more they can do on their own.
This is just the beginning. So this will be the first one that is leaking out. They did a study on 20 of the shipwrecks. And their estimate is from 3.5 to 6 million gallons of oil still in our waters. So that would be a very big devastation if one or two or all of them start leaking out at the same time.
Peter Atten from Chuuk, ending that report by Kyle Evans. The doctor who helped to deliver conjoined twin baby boys in a rural hospital in Papua New Guinea says he didn't think the newborns would survive. Born at the Brown Hospital in Finschhafen, the boys are joined at their lower abdomens. Work is currently underway with the help of a non-government organisation to fly the boys and their mother, Fatima Kevin, to Sydney for surgery. Hilda Wayne spoke to Dr. Kove Womba, who helped deliver the babies. He says twins were expected, but not conjoined.
Fatima Kevin came in as a normal pregnant woman. We admitted her because she had a very, very huge abdomen and we were carrying twin. And of course, we did a scan, not scan, but the fetal Doppler. We used to find the fetal heart. We have detected two hearts on. And we told her that you are expecting twins. So because the fetal heart is telling us, and also your tummy is larger than the size. And during the time of labor, when she went into labor, the presenting part were limbs. So those usually causes obstructions. So also it delays the fetus. Kind of the stages of labor is a bit prolonged, so which prompts us to do a cesarean section. So we prepare for emergency cesarean section, thinking that the first twin might be breech, meaning that the baby doesn't face down to come out first. We surprisingly delivered the conjoined twin, and all of us were surprised. The baby and even the mother was surprised because when the mother is getting the anesthesia was a spinal block, so she was awake during the time of operation. So she was also surprised. Inside the theater as well, so all of us were surprised. But anyways, we just bring the baby to ward. We thought that they would not make it, but for 2 days they survived. So we reached out to other like SMOs and all the consultants. So they said that's how we ended up in Angaroo.
So Manolos Aviation was the help that you all needed to get the babies over to Angaroo.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, Manolos usually medevac only obstetric cases, like those mothers who have difficulty delivering the baby and any complicated related to that. But this was a special case, and we were also grateful for Manolos for helping us.
And Dr. Umba, where the twins joined at?
The joint was at below the umbilical region, just below the umbilical region. They had one umbilical cord. Usually they should have two, but they had one. They had separate limbs. Both legs are separate. Both arms are separate. But the joint is between below the umbilicus. But they had separate heart, separate lungs, and a separate chest. Neck, head is just separate.
Dr. Kove Womba speaking there with Hilda Wayne. Cook Islands has made history, becoming the first Pacific nation to lock in all its maritime boundaries under international law. It follows the United Nations endorsing the country's claim to extend its seabed rights over the vast Manahiki Plateau, adding another 350,000 square kilometres to its ocean territory. The Cook Islands government says it's a proud moment that shows even the smallest island states can lead the way in ocean diplomacy and rule-based governance. Professor Donald Rothwell from the Australian National University is an expert on the Law of the Seas Convention. He tells reporter Evan Wasuka the changes will allow Cook Islands to stake a greater claim on rights to deep sea minerals.
The Cook Islands made a submission to a UN body called the Commission on the Limits of the Continental Shelf back in 2009, and it was seeking to have its continental shelf beyond 200 nautical miles recognised under provisions that sit within the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. So the Cook Islands has been really involved in a diplomatic and political dialogue with that UN commission since 2009. It was asked to revisit some aspects of its submission. And we now have reached a point where the commission has made final and legally binding recommendations to the Cook Islands which confirms the outer limits of the Cook Islands continental shelf, which extend north of the Cook Islands into the Manukiki Plateau.
How is this different from like an expansion of the EEZ? If you can take us through the finer points.
The starting point is that every country has an entitlement to an exclusive economic zone, the EEZ, and a continental shelf of 200 nautical miles. But the continental shelf is a very distinctive geological and geomorphological zone. And so when the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea was concluded in 1982, it was recognised that some countries might in fact have a legitimate continental shelf claim which would extend beyond that 200 nautical mile limit. Here, this gives to the Cook Islands an entitlement to extend its continental shelf beyond that 200 nautical mile limit into northern reaches of the Pacific Ocean, immediately to the north of the Cook Islands.
The Cook Islands is one of the countries that's exploring deep sea mining. Does this seems to give them more territory to continue to explore and to exploit this resource. Is that correct?
Most certainly. So the Cook Islands can legitimately, under the provisions of its Continental Shelf Act, seek to license and give permits to other mining operators to come in to explore and exploit that region, entirely consistently with the provisions of the Law of the Sea Convention, and without the need to have to work through the mechanisms that are currently being overseen by the International Seabed Authority. The reason being is that this has now been recognised as part of the sovereign entitlements of the Cook Islands, over which it has recognised sovereign rights.
Professor Donald Rothwell speaking to Evan Wasuka. Finally, some sport and the family effort to raise the game of basketball in Solomon Islands. Hopes are high that the country's men's basketball side will claim its first Melanesian Cup title, with the competition currently underway in Honiara. One young player in particular is carrying not just the hopes of a nation, but his family as well. Chris and Rita Amanu Leong has the story.
On the court, Bart Kebibasia is a standout player. Outside the box, he is mummy's boy.
So me so proud. Me
I'm so proud of my baby boy, Kirby.
Margaret Basia is Kirby's mum, a former national rep who dedicated her life to the game's development in the country.
Him, a big bro, blame.
He would tag along with his oldest brother, Augustine, who became his coach. What started from a homemade court to the international space makes me proud. Watching Kirby grow under his brother's wings, my baby, to me, he is number one in Solomon Islands.
I'm number one in Solomon Islands.
Kirby isn't the only Basia in this tournament. His sisters are also representing their country. The 22-year-old point guard is the youngest in a family of seven. All of them started dribbling basketballs from a very young age.
Just inspired me, no?
I have drawn so much inspiration from my family who all play basketball. I step into it and I love it. They inspire me to do better.
I'm just inspiring me for me, keep going on.
Kirby is praised for his quickness, court vision and tireless motto. On Monday, a packed friendship hall erupted as the final buzzer sounded, marking a landmark moment for Solomon Islands basketball, their first ever win against Fiji.
Been playing for so long now.
We have been playing together for so long. Our chemistry and connection is there. We just need to find the momentum and keep on playing.
Kirby Basia feels the weight of expectation with Solomon Islands hosting the third FIBA Melanesian Cup.
Big one now. Shootings, bro.
My shootings could be better synchronized, so I'll work harder in the next game.
Go back, train hard for next game, bro.
As a former national rep, Kirby's brother, Austin Basia, still finds his way cheering from the sidelines. He says Kirby is special.
Kirby is the better basketballer. He learnt a lot from our siblings. We have passed on only the good techniques. He brings himself together and now we can see his performance.
Give me looking performance blame this time. Yeah.
Austin was one of the three senior players in 2022 who helped to rebuild the sport in the country. He is confident that basketball's popularity will grow. For him,
it's investing in the younger generation.
We decided that they are one of a special group.
We know the current team is a special group that we have put together. That historical win against Fiji, it's a big moment for basketball in Solomon Islands.
Big moment for basketball Solomon Islands too.
Former Solomon Islands basketball rep Austin Basia, ending that story by Chris and Rita Almanu Leong in Honiara. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Liam Fox. Thanks for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.